the summer, Bob Bob Radio. Brought to you by Check It and Scott.
Today's guest is Ron Green, and Ron Green teaches at a Timber Creek Country Club out in Daphne, Alabama. Ron has been recognized by Golf Magazine as a top 100 instructor. He's also been recognized as Teacher of the Year twice in the Dixie section and Player of the Year twice in the Dixie section. Ron worked with players of abilities from of all ability levels, from beginners up to tour players. And some of his tour players that he's worked with are Joe Durant and Glenn Nocic, Jay Haws, Kenny Perry, and a host of others. And Ron's been a friend for many, many years, and I want to welcome Ron to our show. Hey, Ron, how you doing?
I'm doing terrific, Chuck. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we know you've had little challenges down there lately with all the storms coming in your area. I hope it hasn't been more than you can handle so far.
Well, we've been very lucky. We've been around the edge of Ivan, and it really just missed us just barely, and got a little damage from Dennis and a little damage from Katrina, but really we've kind of been right in the seam, if you will, of all those storms. So we've been very, very lucky, and you know, I've just been trying to help out my friends who got clobbered over Mississippi and New Orleans.
Right, right. And you and I talked about trying to help those guys in any way that we could. So, you know, we've extended the hand. Now it's kind of up to them to take advantage of us, so to speak. So,
that's right.
Give us a little bit of background, Ron, about how you got started in the golf and what it's been like up until you started teaching for a living.
Well, I grew up wanting to play football for Bear Bryant, and it was just too little to do it. In fact, there was one play I remember where a 6'1" freshman in high school, I was the second string quarterback, and he was running a safety blitz. I ran an option, and I got knocked out cold and said, golf's for me. So I got into golf because, again, I was just too small to play other sports, and I wasn't any good. I was bad at golf. I couldn't understand why I practiced harder than everyone else I knew, and they were good, and I wasn't. So it launched me into studying. I figured the only way that I could get better was to study, because I couldn't afford professional help. And so I began to read everything I could get my hands on. I read, memorized Ben Hogan's Five Fundamentals. I used to quote it page after page. In fact, we had a bet one day. I missed an and a V through 21 pages of Ben Hogan's book while we were waiting in a rain delay. And I read John Jacobs' Practical Golf, and I read In Search of the Perfect Swing. And that was the first introduction to science as it related to golf, the Cochrane and Stobbs book written in 1966, all the studies that were done. And that really kind of put me on an edge, I think, that was a little bit more advanced than what was currently being professed. As I went through high school and college and got a little bit better, I decided to turn pro in 1978, and turned pro and had very, very limited success. I just really hardly do anything except practice real hard. And I worked with a lot of different instructors. I worked with Gardner Dickinson. I worked with David Ledbetter. I worked with anybody that would give me an audience. I sat down and listened intently to what they had to say, even the late Sam Bird, who was in Anniston, Alabama at the time, who was Jimmy Ballard's mentor. And I gathered all this information, but I didn't know what to do with it. And it wasn't until I stopped playing in 1985 that I began to study in earnest the golfing machine, and went to see Alex Sloan up in Florida, and he showed me how the book was intended to be used and defined things better for me. I'd read the book, Chuck, before that. I had the book in my hands in 1980, but I was just going in and taking things out of context and trying to verify my own weak system that really had way too many flaws to mention. But it wasn't until 1985 and 86, working with Alex, I began to sort of see the light. In fact, my friend that went with me, Greg Jones, said as we were driving out of Turtle Point, he looked back over his shoulder at Turtle Point Golf Club, and he said, "I have been to Mecca."
Yeah.
And so since 1985, I've been studying it intently. That day doesn't go by where I don't read the book and read parts of the book, and I use it as a foundation to try to help these other guys get better. I think the record speaks for itself. Everyone who has employed it to any length of time to redefine their habits, re-engrave their habits, has had tremendous success.
Well, and I think that part of that process also is anybody that has used it and used it correctly has shown improvement and redefined. There are lots of people that actually, you know, have tried to do things out of the book, but they've done them incorrectly. So, of course, when they do them incorrectly, the book gets all the bad press.
Well, I think what happens to most instructors especially is unless they've had the very valuable opportunity of working with you or working with Alex Sloan or some of the guys that worked with Mr. Kelly directly, they try to use the information to bolster their own preferences. And they get away from principle and start diving into preferences. And then they use the book to back them up. Well, it's not really the way it's supposed to be. The information should stand alone by itself, and the instructor should just relay it to the player,
right?
And relay it in a fashion that allows the player to have freedom to choose his own style, as long as that style and those components and component variations are compatible. Eric can work out just fine. And it's the instructor's job to try to relate to the player when those component variations are not compatible and when they are. And what will work and what won't work together, but give the player the latitude to develop his own style. And I think the history of the game proves that, is that, you know, the greatest players that have ever played, none of them do everything exactly the same. They have their own particular component variations, but the principles remain engraved in stone. The principles never change. The principles are always there. They never become unpopular or out of date. They're consistently embedded in the players' swings of the best players and the best ball strikers that have ever lived.
Right. Well, you know, Ron, I know you work with tour caliber players, and I know you spend a lot of time working with amateurs of different varying degrees. I know you've worked with Nick Cassini quite a bit, and I know you've got some players that are, you know, obviously in the 20 to 30 handicap range when they come to your tee. What do you think the biggest differences, other than the tour players have honed whatever move they have, you know, to play good golf, the biggest differences between the high handicappers and the tournament players?
I think the thing that I see more often than not, that if I can break it up into three parts, I think the tour players have much better educated hands than the novice players or even moderately good players. I think tour players have a much better understanding either from an analytical standpoint or an intuitive standpoint. They understand better what their right arm is supposed to do. And I think the tour players have a much better understanding of sequencing or the order in the downswing. In golfing machine terms, the accumulators 4-1-2-3
right.
Sequence release. I think they have a much better understanding through feel of what that is. And I think the number one difference, if I could take a satellite's view of it, would be that the best players in the world play by feel, but what they're feeling and what they're doing are exactly the same thing. As you go up in handicap from scratch handicap and higher, that gap broadens between what they feel and what the player is doing. They're very, very different. And so the broader the gap, the less often the result, the desired intention has been made. So I think what has to happen on the instructor side is that the instructor has to communicate that the feel of the game is the most important thing. There is no golf without feel. It doesn't exist without feel. Yet, what you're feeling and what you're doing must be identical. The only way to bridge that gap is through mechanics. And so, like Mr. Kelly said, you've got to let mechanics produce and feel reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, the thing that stands in the way of most players improving is that they shy away from the information. They're neglectant of the information because they feel like it's too technical and too mechanical. And they say, I'm a feel player.
Right, I love that one.
Well, what if what you're feeling and what you're doing are not the same thing? Then mm-hmm. as soon as I put any pressure on you, the whole system that you're using implodes because your feel system is flawed to begin with. What if what you're feeling and what you're doing are exactly the same thing? Then the more pressure I put on you, the better it works. Now, which one would you rather use to perform with? And so in my mind, the definition of feel is the most important critical factor in motivating the player to want to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And The problem, Chuck, is that the ball is 1.68 inches, you know, in diameter, and so all the feel is scaled down to 1.68 inches. So if a player makes a 3 or 4 inch change in their swing plane or some other movement, it feels like they're going to miss the ball completely. Mm-hmm. And so it's a scary proposition. And that's why I think if you read what Mr. Kelly said about you have to be willing to miss the ball completely. You don't have to like it, but you have to be willing to. If you can get to that point in your head that you're willing to miss the ball completely to get better, and if you're doing the correct things and you just keep doing the correct things until you no longer miss the ball, I think that's the key factor in anybody from a 40 handicapper to a tour player getting better.
And you're right. I mean, it's like he said, you know, you have to learn how to do something correctly even if you miss the ball until you don't miss it anymore.
That's correct.
In today's society, we are so driven to want instant gratification that most golfers, their golf swingers are a direct result. Their golf swings are a direct result of their perception, number one, of what should happen, and number two, their swings are a result of what they're seeing in their ball flight. So, you know, when you are hitting a shot and it's not going where you want it, you start making compensations, you start making changes. Instead of just focusing on doing whatever you and your instructor are trying to do and letting that start reproduce. You know, it's funny when you said the field players, when people say, well, I'm a field player, I don't play by mechanics. Well, I always said, well, if you don't play by feel, how do you know what you're, if you play by feel, how do you know what you're supposed to feel if you don't have the right mechanics?
That's correct. And what basis do you go back to? If what you're feeling and what you're doing are different, how do you know what to change? And what happens is you end up experimenting, you know, back to your point, which was really great. You end up experimenting and you end up breeding the very thing you're trying to get out of. You
right.
end up changing something on every swing. Well, how can you be consistent if you change something every swing? And I think there are three pylons to what you said, and that is, golf's a really strange game anyway. You know, the lowest score wins, but it's not a race. You have to swing to the right to make it go left and left to make it go right and hit down to make it go up, and you have to be completely focused on the task at hand but relaxed, and the game just throws all these opposites at you all the time. One of the greatest opposites it throws at you is that the fastest way to learn any component variation, any change, is to do it very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very hard thing. Most players want whatever the fee is. If they have $50 less, then they want $50 worth of better shots. Well, the central nervous system doesn't care if it's working correctly or not. It just does what it does what it's the most familiar with. It doesn't care where the ball goes. And those habits are sometimes slow to change. And again, it goes back to boiling it down to one or two very important changes, is sticking with those until they become a habit and then moving on to the next one.
Right. And, you know, things have changed quite a bit since you and I were trying to play. And you know, back those days, we didn't have sports psychologists that were following us around everywhere. We didn't have our swing gurus on the tee as we're getting ready to play. And even before our time, you know, none of those guys had any of the advantages. Or you could say disadvantages in some players'
mm-hmm.
eyes, of the things that are available for players today. And I know you and I have talked about this before, but, you know, one of the things that I see also is, you know, you can have all perfect mechanics, but if you're brain dead, you still can't play golf. If you don't have the physical prowess. And one of those things is Chris, I can't remember Chris's name, big boy from Clemson.
Mm-hmm.
You remember he won a U.S. amateur. He weighed about 400 pounds.
Yeah, I remember who you're talking about. I can't think of his last name either.
But you know, here's a guy that had a lot of mechanical ability, but he does not have the physical stamina. And I know that you spend time with your players trying to get them to go into an exercise routine, some mental game programming, and some other things. Could you give us a little elaboration on that?
The thing is, you're right. The resources available now are just, they're 100-fold back when you and I were trying to play. It's amazing that any of us ever, you know, broke 70, given now what we know.
Yeah.
But one of the key factors, and Mr. Kelly talked about it in the book, is that, you know, your body can only do, your swing can only be as good as your body will let it be good. I mean, you can't have any more precision than your body will allow you to have. Well, now with the 15 plus years of biomechanical research into the golf swing, you can change your body so that if there's a particular part of the swing that's giving you problems, you'll be able to do it. The most important thing I stress to the players I work with is that it's not flexibility, although that's important. It's not range of motion, although that's important. The most important factor in being your championship golfer is stamina. You develop, if you have over 100 miles an hour club head through the driver, it's about 4 tons of pressure at the moment the club hits the ball and its separation. And it's about six times the energy that you would put forth doing 4 times your heaviest bench press in that 1 millisecond, that 1/5,000th of a second. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of energy going into that little tiny space. And then you add walking, if you're walking and you add up and down hills and you add different atmospheric conditions. So stamina is the number one thing that any guy, any golfer, any player, any gal wants to get better. They got to develop stamina so that you can practice and play. Without the stamina, the body just falls apart. So I think if any player wants to dramatically reduce their handicap, they've got to work on their body first. Before they even go to an instructor, they've got to work on the body first. Go get a head-to-toe assessment. Find out where you're strong, where you're weak, where you're loose, where you're tight. Figure out what's going on underneath the skin. Develop some sort of routine that's, 15 to 30 minutes a day long. Just 15 to 30 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And then start in on your working with your authorized instructor to be able to develop the mechanical changes you need, because there's just a limit to what an instructor can do. I love to use the analogy, Chuck, that if I show up at Daytona in Tony Stewart's car, I'm going to get killed because I don't know how to drive that car. Mm-hmm. It's a great car, but I don't know what to do with it. On the other hand, if Tony Stewart shows up at Daytona in a Volkswagen, he's going to get killed. It doesn't matter what he knows about driving and how many races he's won, how good he is, because he doesn't have the tools he needs. He doesn't have the equipment he needs to compete. So it's a delicate blend, isn't it, of keeping your mental skills and your mental equipment, your mental toolbox up to speed with your physical. And what you and I see every day is that there are players whose physical ability is far outrunning their ability to program that swing. And there are players who have unbelievable competitive skills, but their swing just lets them down all the time. And it's really tough to discern. I mean, it's really a judgment call, isn't it?
It is, and I think there's basically four components to, if you really want to improve your golf game. Number one, you got to have the proper mechanics. Number two, you have to have the right mental frame or the mental makeup. Number three, you have to be physically capable of doing whatever it is you want to do. And number four, you've got to have, and you touched on, you got to have equipment that plays to your strength. It's much like buying a suit off the rack for guys. The pants might fit, but the coat never does.
Exactly.
So
right.
You've got to have the right tools, And the thing I see is people coming to the tee, and they have it. 8.5 degree loft driver because some tour players got an 8.5 degree loft driver, and they'd be much better off, with 10.5 degrees. And I know you do that a lot also on your tee. You check their equipment to see if it's a benefit to them or if it's a hindrance.
It is. I have a fancy launch monitor. I'm very fortunate. I have a fancy launch monitor and a lot of great diagnostic equipment. And irrespective of what the player believes is happening, I can measure it. And he can look at it or she can look at it. And we can measure exactly what's going on versus, again, what the player thinks is going on. And it's terrific. I think the most important improvement in learning for the player has been the advent of video and the ability to use geometry and draw lines and planes and angles right there on the screen. And for the player to see with their own eyes what's really happening, I think you'll agree that back in the dark ages when we first started teaching and didn't have all this stuff, we spent 90% of the lesson trying to convince the player that we knew what we were talking about. And there was very little teaching that really went on. I found that in the last 6 years especially, that actually the fewer words that are used and the more visual and feel-oriented things that are used, the faster the players learn. Whereas before, we didn't have that. We had to use words and be convincing and persuasive. Now the technology is allowing all of that to get over with very quickly so you can get right to the changes. I remember Charlie Sorrell, the great Charlie Sorrell out of Georgia, would make up poems for every lesson so the players would remember what it was that he mm-hmm. was teaching them. He admired Muhammad Ali because he would make up the poems and people would remember the fights because of Ali's poems. Everyone remembers the "I'm going to kill the gorilla and the thrill of Manila." I mean, everybody remembers that. Yeah. It's been 40 years ago, 30 years ago, excuse me. So Charlie would say things like, "Shift the weight to both arms straight, and there's no doubt to great." And how could you forget that? And so right. now we don't have to worry about that. We can make DVDs and videos of the lessons and give them to players to use as a reference point. And we can print out sheets of what they do with launch conditions with all the clubs, not only the driver, but every club. And they can get a very clear picture of exactly where they are. So there's no doubt as to where they are and what they need to do to get better. And it's a little less of a, Mr. Kelly said it best, it's no longer the blind struggle, it's the guided struggle.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we know that there are three imperatives that the players, you know, have to obey: a straight plane line, club head, leg, pressure point, and a flat left wrist. But if you had to pick one thing that you work on more than anything with your players, and you would suggest to high handicappers to work on, what would that be?
The relentless pursuit of precision.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not the answer you wanted, but that's what I would say. The relentless pursuit of precision. I mean, just day in, day out, when you're standing in the office, when you're driving in the car, if you look off, if you cherish it like you and I do, then the relentless pursuit of precision, and a lot of that energy is intellectual, it's not physical. How can I do this better? All right, I know I need to have a flat left wrist and or a bent right wrist impact. How can I do that better? I know I need to have leg pressure points, and I need to work on, my instructor tells me I need to work on this one. How can I do that better? You know, how can I get there faster? What can I do that will engrave that pattern into my central nervous system?
I'd like to thank Ron Green for taking time out of his schedule to talk to us today. And for those of you interested in reaching Ron and trying to work with him and help your golf stroke, you can reach him at Green Golf in Daphne, Alabama at Timber Creek Country Club. And the phone number is 251-401-6225. You can also reach him through their website, which is gringolf, gringgolf.com. Thanks again, Ron, and we appreciate all your time.
Valley of the Sun, Golf Radio.